I was a 45-year-old married man, living a seemingly perfect life in a quiet suburb. But one night, a single mistake shattered everything. I slept with my daughter's 25-year-old best friend. What began as a moment of weakness spiraled into a web of manipulation, blackmail, and psychological torment. She threatened to expose our secret unless I complied with her every demand. As I fought to protect my family and sanity, I realized I had to turn the tables. This is the story of how I set her up and watched as justice took its course. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform now, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. I never planned for it to happen. Hell, I didn't even see it coming. One moment, I was a 45-year-old husband grilling ribs in the backyard, flipping meat, sipping bourbon, playing the dutiful suburban dad. The next moment, I was locked in the kind of eye contact that makes your body forget right and wrong. Her name was Arielle Miles, my daughter's best friend since high school. 25, whip-smart, gorgeous, and dangerous in that way some women don't even try to be. She wore a sheer white blouse that day, unbuttoned just enough to whisper rebellion. Her body language was confident, feline, and deliberate. When she laughed at my joke, she leaned in, eyes sharp, fingers lightly brushing my wrist. Innocent enough to ignore, calculated enough to burn into my memory. I told myself it was nothing. A fluke, hormones, boredom. But deep down, some dark force had already opened the door. The night came slow, heavy with alcohol and tension. My daughter, Mira, went upstairs early, tired from the sun. My wife was out of town visiting her sister in D.C. Arielle stayed behind, claiming she wasn't sleepy and wanted to talk about grown-up things. I should have shut it down. Instead, I poured another drink. We sat on the patio, lights dimmed, the scent of jasmine and bourbon wrapping around us like a secret. "Do you ever feel like you're just existing?" she asked. "More often than I'd admit," I said, surprised by my honesty. She turned to me. "You're different than most men I know. Most men are just noise. You think. You feel. You see things." It wasn't a compliment. It was a weapon. She was scanning for weakness, running a cognitive psychology test dressed up as flirtation. Her pupils dilated when I answered. Her voice dropped a note. "You ever think about doing something reckless?" That was it. The first strike. We didn't kiss right away. There was no dramatic lunge. Just an invisible cord pulling us closer. She stood up, walked into the kitchen barefoot, and poured herself another drink. "Want something stronger?" she called back. I followed. I shouldn't have. The kitchen was warm, too warm. Her skin glowed under the pendant light. She placed her glass down and turned, slowly, deliberately. Then, without hesitation, she pressed her lips to mine. It wasn't lust. It was control. I could have pulled away. Could have ended it right there. But something inside me, years of quiet resentment, dulled masculinity, marital monotony, snapped loose. I kissed her back. We stumbled into the hallway, knocking over a chair. Her body molded to mine like it had rehearsed this scene 1,000 times. Her breath was hot, her voice a whisper laced with intent. "I've wanted you for years." She knew what she was doing. She knew the danger. And still, she didn't hesitate. We ended up in the guest room. Clothes hit the floor like confessions. Every movement was frantic, needy, drenched in guilt. The sex was violent in its desperation, and I'd be lying if I said I wasn't just as hungry as she was. But in the middle of it, something shifted. She whispered, "You'll think about this every night." "You think so?" "Yeah, for sure you will." And just like that, I knew. This wasn't about sex. It was about power. About twisting the act into something she could wield. When it was over, she smiled, not with sweetness, but with knowledge. Like she'd won something. "You don't have to say anything," she said as she got dressed. "We'll just keep this between us. Unless..." She paused in the doorway, eyes locked on mine. "Unless what?" "Unless you lie to me." Then she left. I stood alone in the silence, heartbeat thundering. And in that stillness, something ancient stirred. A whisper in the shadows. "You've been marked." My mind was racing. My moral compass was shattered. But worse than guilt was the gnawing truth. She wasn't done with me. This was only the beginning. The morning after felt like a crime scene. I woke up drenched in sweat, the sheets tangled around my legs like ropes. The guest room still smelled like her, floral perfume and sweat. Her lipstick smudged the pillow. My body ached, but it wasn't physical. It was shame. A chemical kind of regret. one that stains your soul and doesn't wash off in the shower. I couldn't look at myself in the mirror, not because I hated what I saw, but because I knew I'd do it again if I had the chance. My mind was racing, replaying everything. The curve of her body, the way she whispered my name, the way she watched me, not like a lover, but like a lab experiment, a behavioral study in real time, cognitive psychology at its dirtiest. I checked my phone, no messages, but something told me that was worse than her texting me. Arielle was the kind of woman who planned her silence. She wanted me on edge, and it worked. By the time Mira came downstairs for breakfast, I was pouring coffee with trembling hands. She was glowing, excited about an interview she had that day. I could barely hear her. Every smile she gave felt like a blade. If she ever finds out. Later that afternoon, I heard the garage door open. Arielle. She walked in like she owned the place. Crop top. No bra. Denim shorts that left little to the imagination. Her smile was fire and ice. Hey, Mr. D. I stared at her, saying nothing. She walked up close. Too close. You don't have to act weird, she said. Last night was fun. You needed it. My voice came out strained. This can't happen again. She cocked her head like I just told her the sky was green. Happen again? You think you're calling the shots? Then she leaned in, whispering in my ear. You came inside me. My stomach dropped. You said you were on. She pressed a finger to my lips. Maybe I was. Maybe I wasn't. She pulled away with a devilish grin and walked upstairs like nothing happened. The days that followed were a slow descent into psychological hell. I tried to avoid her, but Arielle made it impossible. She was always around. At dinner. In the living room. Walking past me in towels that barely stayed on. She played with body language like an artist, crossing legs, biting lips, watching my reactions like they were data points. It wasn't flirting anymore. It was warfare. She began leaving little messages for me. Notes folded in my work jacket. A pair of her underwear stuffed under my driver's seat. And the worst, a text that read, "Your wife has pretty eyes. Would be a shame if they looked at you differently." I deleted it instantly. That night, I couldn't sleep. I lay awake staring at the ceiling while my wife breathed peacefully beside me. My brain was flooded with shadowed secrets, fear, and emotional decision-making spiraling out of control. I'd dealt with manipulative personalities before, co-workers, a boss, even my own father. But this? Arielle was something else. She didn't just want control. She wanted domination. She caught me alone again the following week. I was in the garage, fixing a shelf just to stay busy. She cornered me, her tone softer this time. "I need your help," she said, twirling a strand of hair. "I got into some trouble. My ex is being weird. Might have sent some pictures of us to some people." I froze. "Pictures?" She nodded. "Nothing too bad yet." My voice cracked. "What the hell are you talking about?" Her eyes lit up. "Relax." I told him I'd delete them. But he's the jealous type. If you help me pay off a few things, I'll make sure everything disappears. There it was. The trap. The price of silence. And suddenly, I realized I wasn't being blackmailed by accident. This was engineered. She'd studied me. My weakness. My patterns. My guilt. She knew exactly how to manipulate a man drowning in shame, and she was using dark psychology like a scalpel. I drove around for an hour after that. No destination. Just motion. Trying to make sense of what was happening. Do I tell my wife? Do I confront Arielle? Do I pay? But every path ended in ruin. The worst part. A small, sick part of me was still addicted to her. To the danger. To the power she had. To the fact that I was now part of something I couldn't just walk away from. This wasn't a mistake anymore. It was a game. And she was winning. There's a moment when you stop wondering if it'll all fall apart. And you start calculating when. For me, that moment came on a Thursday morning. My wife was laughing in the kitchen, humming to herself while packing Myra's lunch. A Spotify playlist rolled softly in the background. Eggs sizzled. Everything looked like normal life. Except I couldn't breathe, because Arielle had texted me 5 minutes earlier. "You said you loved the way I moaned. Wanna hear it again? I'm recording now." Attached was a voice note. I didn't open it. Not because I didn't want to, but because I knew once I did, I'd lose one more piece of control. One more inch of my soul to this specter who had crawled into every crevice of my existence. At work, I tried to focus, meetings, numbers, fake smiles. But the work dynamics were starting to feel different. A few glances from the interns, A weird silence when I walked into the server room. Something was shifting. That same afternoon, Ariel showed up at the coffee shop next to my office. Dressed in that subtle way she weaponized, casual, sexy, effortless. She wore sunglasses, even though it was overcast. She sat one table behind me. "Order for Daniel," the barista called. That was my name. She knew I'd hear it. I turned slowly, and she raised her cup in mock salute, smirking. She mouthed the words, "Check your email." I opened it in my car. A burner Gmail address. No subject line. Just 4 attachments. Photos. Screenshots. Dates. IP logs. All documenting the night. All timestamped. All undeniable. And then the message. "This is what your family court file would look like if you ever crossed me. Don't test my ability to destroy you. Offshore accounts are easy to create. Don't make me prove it." That line hit different. Offshore accounts? That was a term you didn't use casually. It implied intent. Money laundering. Financial crimes. This wasn't just social manipulation anymore. This was tactical escalation. Ariel wasn't just some hot, troubled girl. She was playing a long game. That night, I snapped. I drove to her apartment. I didn't knock, just burst in. She didn't scream. She smiled. "You finally came to me." I grabbed her phone, but she didn't resist. "Everything's backed up," she whispered. "On 3 different clouds. Encrypted. Think I didn't learn anything from watching my dad get eaten alive in court." Her voice was calm. Collected. "Influence psychology in motion. I want $20,000, she said. "By the end of the month, you'll wire it to the account I give you. Or, your daughter finds out first. Then your wife. Then your job." I stood there shaking. "Why are you doing this?" She leaned in, brushing my chest with her fingers. "Because I can." The next few days blurred. I barely ate. I lost sleep. I snapped at Mira over something stupid. My wife asked me if I was okay. I lied, of course. Told her it was work. Stress. Aging. But the truth was, I was unraveling. My body was reacting to trauma I couldn't show. Tight chest. Twitchy muscles. Cold sweats. The effects of mind manipulation, of being hunted with no weapon. Every time I checked my email, my heart dropped. Every time my phone buzzed, I panicked. I looked at everyone differently. Were they in on it? Did Ariel loop someone else in? Was she watching me now? She sent me another photo. This one of her and Mira, smiling at brunch. Her caption: "She loves me. Would hate to lose me." That night, I opened my laptop and did something I hadn't done in years. I started researching psychological principles, legal traps, evidence admissibility, and entrapment laws. I needed to understand how predators thought, how dark forces maneuvered in plain sight. It hit me like a slap. She had me trapped not just with evidence, but with emotion. She'd studied my personality, my guilt, my shame, my need to be the good man, and she was using every ounce of that against me. I began planning. I called a friend, an old law school classmate who now worked in private digital forensics. I told him I suspected a social engineering blackmail situation, but needed to be discreet. He didn't ask questions. He just said, "Start recording everything." So I did. I put a keylogger on her laptop, the one I helped her pick out for work. I began syncing her messages, mapping her movement, tracking her behavioral cues, her group behavior patterns, her emotional tells. She thought she was the spider, but now I was building my own web. I used to believe that people crack in silence, that breakdowns are private, internal things. I was wrong. When it happens, it's loud. It shows up in your voice when you bark at your daughter for asking a question. It's in the pause you take when your wife kisses you on the cheek. It's in the reflection of your own eyes when you can't recognize the man staring back. I was coming undone, and the worst part? Ariel was enjoying it. She escalated in ways I didn't think were possible. It started with a voicemail from my boss. "Hey Daniel, just wanted to give you a heads up. Someone's been sending screenshots of messages with your name on them. You might want to come in early tomorrow, and maybe bring HR into the loop." I froze. Screenshots? I checked my phone. Nothing. Then my email. And there it was. Ariel had forwarded doctored messages, spliced from our texts, rearranged, reframed, to my supervisor, anonymously, with the subject line: "Predator in the office. Protect your staff." I knew exactly what she was doing. Audio manipulation. Message manipulation. Social manipulation. A masterclass in influence warfare. She was planting seeds, not just in my family, but now at work. and she chose her targets well. HR, the female admin, two junior staffers, the ones I'd helped get promoted, the ones who now weren't returning my good morning nods. That night, I confronted her. She was waiting for me in the parking lot of my gym, hoodie up, leaning on her car like some sexy version of death itself. I approached with my fists clenched. "You sent those emails?" Her response, "I said I needed money. You said no. Now I'm just exploring options." My voice shook. "You're destroying my life." She laughed. "You destroyed your own life when you fucked your daughter's best friend in a guest room three doors down from your wife." Then she leaned in, soft and slow. "I have a backup of the video. And this time, I'm sending it to Mira. Unless you wire 50 grand. Offshore. I'll give you the routing number." I stared at her. She was cold. Not angry. Not erratic. Just calculated. This wasn't some girl who lost her way. This was a predator in designer boots. I went home, sat in my car in the driveway for an hour, and wept. I wasn't built for this. I wasn't some street-savvy gangster. I was a suburban husband who made a catastrophic mistake. A man raised on ethical standards who now had a creaking crypt of secrets weighing on his chest. My phone buzzed again. This time, a video link. It was me. And her. From behind. A blurry angle. But enough. The moaning. The movement. The guilt captured in HD. And in the background, the sound of my daughter's laughter, from another room. I threw up on the grass. That's when something shifted. I stopped feeling fear, and started feeling rage. Over the next 72 hours, I built a new version of myself. One who stopped flinching. One who studied group dynamics and cognitive behavior like a weapon. I called my friend in cyber forensics again. "We need to trap her," I said. "Legally. Surgically." He didn't hesitate. We set up a decoy account under a fake name, created the illusion of a lucrative job offer, something remote, sexy, and shady, marketing for a shell company with access to confidential data and bank-level credentials. We called it Aventura Group. We knew Ariel would sniff it out. She'd be drawn to the smell of power, secrecy, and the promise of offshore accounts. Sure enough, she bit. She responded to the fake recruiter's message in less than 3 hours. Three messages in, she offered to trade encrypted footage for access to the server. Five messages in, she said she could be more than an asset, that she could supply more than files. 10 messages in, she sent a 15-second clip of me naked, half-blurred, with the text, "This is just a taste. I'm worth your risk." I watched the footage from the server room we had mirrored. I read her exact language. I watched how she calibrated her pitch like a pro. It was influence mastery, laced with dark psychology, and a dose of sexual intimidation. She had no idea she was writing her own affidavit. We captured everything. My friend packaged the metadata. We called a contact in digital crimes. And I made the call I never thought I'd make. "Detective Wells, I'd like to report a case of extortion and potential revenge porn distribution." There's a kind of silence that feels like victory long before the war is won. That's what I felt the morning Ariel took the bait. It started with a reply to our decoy job listing. "I'm ready to prove my value. I can access people. Private people. Their data, their vices. I have samples." Attached was a 21-second audio clip. My voice. Whispering her name. Cursing. Breathing heavy. It wasn't just blackmail. It was audio manipulation. She had used spliced phrases from our past conversations, edited like a podcast trailer from hell, designed to sound intimate and illegal. My friend in cyber forensics flagged it instantly. "She's crossed into federal territory now," he said. "This is no longer about sex. This is wire fraud, identity misrepresentation, and digital extortion using engineered content." And just like that, I had actionable intelligence. We built the trap like engineers, emotionally, psychologically, and digitally. The recruiter, played by my friend via VPN, offered her a job managing exclusive digital marketing campaigns for offshore brands with sensitive databases, the kind where a person with the right clearance could hypothetically erase a file. Or two. She couldn't resist. She asked for a meeting. We rented a temporary office under a shell LLC, Redline North Solutions. Downtown. Floor 14. Cameras hidden in the thermostat, the light fixtures, even the server room access panel. A clean glass table. One laptop. One USB stick with blank drive partitions. This wasn't about hacking. This was about exposing her behavior in real time, catching her crossing every line in high-definition clarity. The day of the meeting, I sat in a surveillance van 3 floors below, headset on, heartbeat like a war drum. Then I saw her arrive. Black dress, confident walk, clipboard in one hand, cell phone in the other. Like she was walking into a modeling audition, not a trap designed to end her. She entered the room and sat across from our fake recruiter. He leaned forward and smiled, keeping his voice calm, polite, professional. "We're excited to bring you on board, but first, a little compliance check." She smirked. "I know how to play the game," she said. He opened the laptop and prompted her to insert the USB. What she didn't know was the USB activated a cloned environment, a safe sandbox where every click, every keystroke, every camera tap was being recorded. She opened her cloud folders. She hovered over a file labeled d_footage_final_it.mov. Then she spoke without hesitation. "I got this from a married man. He'll pay anything to keep it buried. Or we use it to make a splash." Bam. Right there. Manipulation tactics in motion. Intent declared. "My friend asked one final question. And you're prepared to use this to get influence in offshore media markets?" Her reply. "I don't need influence. I am the influence." And with that line, she sealed it. Within 10 minutes of her leaving the building, 3 plainclothes officers approached her on the sidewalk. One of them calmly said, "Arielle Miles, we have a few questions about your digital communications. You're not under arrest." Yet, she froze, then smiled. "Lawyer," she said instantly. But the game was over. We had everything, communication tools, video and audio engineering, data logs, voice samples, intent language, digital transfer attempts. She walked in thinking she was above the law. She walked out under investigation. That night, I sat in my car again. Same driveway. Same silence. But this time, I didn't feel like I was drowning. I felt like I had survived something brutal. Something primal. Something few people would ever understand. Because I wasn't just fighting for my family anymore. I was fighting for the part of me she almost rewrote. The part that still believed in ethical persuasion. In human dynamics that weren't designed to manipulate or destroy. She weaponized my mistake. She designed a narrative. But now, I was writing the ending. It was quiet when they finally came for her. 2 months after the sting. After the footage, the transcripts, the emails, all signed, sealed, and submitted. After the Department of Justice picked up the case, citing patterned digital extortion and revenge pornography involving interstate communications. The charge list was long. What wasn't included was the psychological manipulation she wove into my life. The way she rewired my marriage, fractured my relationship with Mira, and turned my home into a battlefield of secrets. But I knew, and that was enough. The morning of the court date, I stood outside the courthouse in a charcoal suit, watching people file in. No one looked at me. No one knew who I was. That was the deal. My name would stay off the record. No cameras. No press. Just buried bylines and unspoken truths. But she saw me. They led her in wearing beige slacks, no makeup, her hair pulled back in a ponytail like a college student about to take an exam. She didn't blink, didn't smirk, just stared at me with those same cold eyes that once begged me to touch her in silence, now full of contempt. The hearing was short. She pled not guilty, of course. Her lawyer called it a consensual affair between adults and said the alleged threats were exaggerated, taken out of context, possibly fabricated. But the evidence? Bulletproof. Multiple clips. Intent statements. Digital transfer logs. Her own voice offering to weaponize footage for offshore manipulation. Her own words gave her away. That's the thing about dark psychology. It always leaves fingerprints. No matter how slick you are, the patterns give you up. When it was over, the judge ordered her held without bail. 6 counts of digital extortion. 3 counts of attempted blackmail. Federal charges pending review. Up to 18 years if convicted. My wife was in the gallery. She hadn't said a word to me that morning. We drove in separate cars. Sat in different pews. She knew enough. I had told her, piece by piece, after Arielle's arrest. Not everything, but enough. Mira still didn't know. She moved to Denver for grad school a week before the court date. I kept her out of it. Out of the spotlight. Away from the poison that had stained our family's name without ever touching it. That night, I opened a bottle of bourbon, the same one I drank the night this started. Same glass, same spot on the back porch. But I didn't drink to Arielle. I drank to consequence. to the line between mistake and manipulation, to the razor-thin difference between a weakness and a war. I'd spent months studying cognitive strategies, reading about influence psychology, watching how con artists engineer chaos through intimacy. What I learned: they don't want money. They want control. They want the narrative. And Ariel almost took mine. Now, I live with the aftershocks. My wife and I go to therapy. Some nights we sleep apart, some nights together. There's no roadmap for this kind of damage. Just complex emotions, critical perspective, and a willingness to hurt less today than you did yesterday. I don't answer unknown numbers anymore. I check every corner twice. And every once in a while, I still dream about her. Not sexually, not romantically, but in that societal manipulation way. That sick curiosity. What was broken in her? What part of her soul needed to make mine bleed? The DA called me last week. Trial date is set. Jury selected. They're confident. Once we finish this, he said, she won't have access to anyone for a very long time. I nodded, because this time, justice wouldn't be poetic. It would be surgical.